Welcome to the Open Book Podcast. What you're about to hear is a recording of a live event that took place at the September 2025 edition of the Open Book Festival. In this event, called The Secret Keepers, Nadia Kasim, Bonnie Espy, and Andrew Robert Wilson speak to Paleso Motsumi about how the truth refuses to remain hidden. Here's their conversation.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the session titled The Secret Keepers with Bonnie Espy, Andrew Robert Wilson, and Nadia Kasim. We're just trying to get some housekeeping out of the way, so please be patient with us as we try to figure out the lighting in the room. We're trying to get the lighting so that we are able to give you the best experience as possible, especially when it comes to the reading of the text. And as somebody that's a reader, I think that's very important, and who has poor vision, I think it's important to just get the lighting correct. My name is Palesa Sekgomotso Motsumi. I am an arts writer by profession and also someone that is an avid reader of fiction and also nonfiction. The Open Book is quite a special place that we all gather every year, and I think these are important conversations to have with different authors and different voices in South Africa. To start us off, I think one of the things that I was very curious to know, that I've also let the authors know as well, well in advance, is to find out what has been on their mind lately. I think that's something that is very much connected to the types of conversations that we have internally with ourselves, and that could also be a truth-telling moment. So I'll start with Nadia.
Good.
Good.
Relief.
Hi, guys. So, to be honest, the first thing that comes to mind is rest.
Yeah.
No, I don't think anybody really understands how much work goes into after publication for an author, marketing their work, attending interviews, etc. But in the literary sense, my role as storyteller has been at the forefront of my thoughts, because my book is regarded in my community as quite controversial. I've been thinking a lot about my role and the responsibility that I have towards myself and my community, and what is the way forward, really. How much am I allowed to disclose in future with regards to my stories?
Absolutely. I think you did in part answer some of the questions that I have, but I think we'll deep dive into those as well as we go into the conversation. And Bonnie, what has been on your mind lately?
I wish I could give some really important political thing to say I'm worried about, or status of the world, but actually I'm worried about the sequel of this book. That's where I'm at. I'm at almost finished it, but I'm not quite, and it's always that ending that's got to be perfect. So that's where what's on my mind right now.
That's also something that I can relate to as a writer. I'm always thinking about the next thing as I'm about to finish writing that present piece, right?
Yeah.
But I think you're right. Your book presents a good opportunity for a sequel. Yeah. So congratulations on the sequel.
Thank you.
And Andrew, what has been on your mind?
Well, I'll go with Bonnie partway and say also my second book's like maybe 10 pages from the end. And before I do that, I've now gone right back to the beginning to make sure I don't muck it up. So that I know where I'm going, and I'm not missing anything before I write that last bit, even though it's in my head already. Mm. And then the other thing is, I have a horror of what's going on in the world. I'm sure, like everyone does, the fascism, the everything that's happening all over. You name a country, you know, name a leader, if that's what you can call them, and that fills me with complete horror at where it's going, because the obvious comparisons to what has gone on in the past, it's obvious, you know, the direction things are taking, and it's quite frightening. And yeah, I guess people like writers, poets, and artists, visual artists, dancers, anyone in the arts has sort of a punch to deliver, I'm sure, and should, I think.
I think you're right. I think based on the previous talk that I just that we just had with such wonderful speakers speaking about Gaza and what's happening, it's quite important to contextualize also through the arts and the writing that we partake in. And I think you're absolutely right. The horrors of this world are quite frightening, and the pace in which things are happening is quite frightening as well. So every day we're living with the question of what's going to happen next. So I think that's also quite important to reflect on. But moving on to our topic, which is quite interesting, the secret keepers. I'm wondering, from just the concept of the secret or a secret, do you think writers are secret revealers or secret, are they able to keep secrets intentionally so, or are they secret keepers,
revealers,
secret keepers? You can choose which one you think writers.
Funny enough, I was told a secret last night, and I said, "Oh, but you're a writer, you'll tell." I said, "I promise I won't tell." So there you are. I'm a secret keeper, I think.
Okay. All right. Nadia?
I'm not a secret keeper. Okay. Yeah, quite the opposite. And I think my writing kind of reveals that.
Yeah.
Because every single thing that is in there is revealing more and more about my community and how we do things. And there's a lot that people want to hide, push under the rug, pretend that we are all perfect. And I'm all about exposing that stuff. Yeah. And even when it comes to people in the real world, I observe a lot and I make a lot of deductions and trying. And somehow people open up to me a lot about their personal lives and stuff. So, yeah. But
we won't tell you any secrets.
You know. Like they say, you might just find it in the next novel.
In the next novel. Okay. I'm happy to hear that we have two. I'm a secret keeper, by the way. So if you tell me a secret, it's going to stick with me for a very long time. Unless I have a good reason to share it that has a lifelong impact on another person. I think that's important to say out loud. I've kept a lot of people's secrets, and I'll die with them. Andrew, are you a secret keeper?
I think I think I'm a bit of both, actually. A bit like the character, the book I wrote. It's a bit sort of in the middle, and then we'll lean there and lean there. But I would keep your secret if you told me something. But I also like to reveal and tear apart a bit of diplomacy, because I don't like it. It's an irritating thing, and, you know, people, you know, that's why they're comedy movies about someone who cannot but tell the truth.
Exactly.
You know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Which brings me to some of the questions that I've been thinking through with other writers, and I think I've shared with you that the writers that I've been listening to over the past few months preparing for this conversation, and one of them is a favorite of mine called, and her name is well known throughout the literary space, and is Zadie Smith. And when asked about her first debut novel, White Teeth, she narrated a point in her writing life that is very important that I wanted to actually share with the audience. So she was in conversation with Ya Gayasi, and she was asked about White Teeth and how it came about. My question to you as a panel here is, why these books? Why was it so important to write such debut novels and with such great subject matters? I'll start with Andrew.
Okay. Mine, excuse me, was triggered by a story I came across, actually at the museum in a town near to where I live, which is Oudtshoorn. And it's one of those little war stories that just slides under the radar, and some very few people, I thought, know about it. And I ended up being correct, and that is the 500 Polish children who were brought out from the war, from Siberian labor camps after the start of the Second World War. Russia and the Nazis were part of the same group. They tore Poland apart, and these Polish children were shipped out, some with parents, but mostly they were orphaned. The parents had been killed. And their journey from Siberia, ending up in on a ship, docking in Port Elizabeth and being taken to Oudtshoorn, where these 500 kids spent the rest of the war from 1943 on. And I thought this is such a fascinating tale to tell. And I had a fiction developing around it. And so my book straddles that period in the 40s and then the apartheid states of emergency in the 80s, where those kids are now older. They're in their late 50s. And so my book straddles those two, both fraught, both wartime, both tense periods in history as well. And of course, I wove through that a love story and a murder mystery. And so it was that that inspired me to write. A story you think, wow, someone's got to tell this. You know, so yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. Somebody has to tell that story. I have a deep affinity for the Karoo, and we just chatted about that earlier on, where I got to learn a little bit more about the cultural sector, that side. So I think this book is very important for those that are living and that have lived before in that area. So thank you so much for writing this very poignant piece of writing. Nadia, I think I also shared my real admiration for the kind of book that you've written as a first-time writer. Why this book, and why did you choose to write about these characters in the way that you did?
So I always like to write from a sense of knowing, so hence it's based in my community. A lot of Muslim Indian authors, I feel, tend to shy away from talking about the community in a controversial manner. They try to portray the community as a very perfect sort of, you know, I don't know if you can call it an entity or, you know, and they try to speak about it in religious terms in a very positive manner. And for me, I mean, my lived experience is not always positive. It has not been always positive. And for me, it was very important to showcase the truth about the modern Muslim Indian family, the modern Muslim Indian way of handling things, the way in which we have taken still very cultural things from decades, you know, and still apply it today. So it was revealing the secrets, you know, that people feel uncomfortable. And that was actually because I had a helper whose son had been diagnosed with this illness, and I empathized, and I felt the need to explore, you know, stigma when it comes to certain illnesses in South Africa in general.
I think you absolutely nailed it. Because reading from the first page up until right to the end, you see the journey that this character takes, how this character transforms, and the relationships that he has with various people. I'm very actually impressed how you wrote the protagonist Tasneem in the story, and it can be a very universal story with any type of person, and I encourage everybody to really get a copy and read the story that she's written. It's quite a beautiful one. Bonnie, I also have this thing where I admire, and I know you're going to have another conversation around friendships between Sylvie and Winifred. or wins, as Sylvie likes to, you know, express in the book. Can you tell us about that? How did you get to this point of writing such a magical book around these two women?
So I think your original question is, how did you start with the book? So
yes.
I moved from Johannesburg to a small village, and the village started to provide me with characters. Typical village. Villages, I mean, you know, the rumors go around, it's the broken telephone, things happen. Halfway through the book, I realized it was becoming, two little old ladies in a village, it was becoming a little cozy for me, too cozy for me, so I throw in a couple of secrets, basically. So
yes, yes.
To make sure that it's not
to purely to disrupt.
A cozy crime. Not that there's anything wrong with cozy, but
yes.
I just thought it would be nice to spice things up with
exactly.
the two ladies ending up having a secret that they differ on as how they should deal with it.
Exactly.
But there's a common thread between them, although they literally are very, you know, have different morals.
Mm.
And, yeah, small village politics, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I can relate to that because I come from a very small town, and small towns usually have the most spiciest people ever. So I think also one of the things that I enjoyed with Not Another Samosa Run is the kind of ways that you've built the story around Tasneem's parents and their relationship. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I think that relationship is quite interesting in the way that you've built these characters. I enjoy reading about Farouk and also Tasneem's mother, who manages to run everybody over and rule the household. Can you please tell us about that?
So in Indian communities, and I'm sure that applies to a lot of close-knit communities, parents play a big, big part in decision-making. And in a sense, they do take control. They control their children. They love to control their kids, you know. Where do you school? What you should study, you know, who you should be, who you should marry.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't write a story without including the parents, because they play such a pivotal role. Too much of a role as well. You know, the children end up not having enough freedom to make their own decisions. So, and I think mothers in particular, some can be overbearing, you know, and when it comes to daughters, you know, the kind of pressures they put on their daughters. And also, I mean, we come from a generation, and maybe my mom's generation more than my generation, where there's a lot of pressure to be a certain type of woman.
Mm.
You know, you got to know how to cook if you're going to make your man happy. You've got to know how to be a homemaker, you know. It's literally centered around the role of a woman.
Mm.
So the character of Fatima is that kind of mother that we are all familiar with.
Definitely.
You know? And Farouk is like the father who I think a lot of people would identify their fathers with him in our community. You know, the father that's like, that's your role, woman. You need to do this and you need to do that. And you just use my credit card all day. and you splurge on influences and what they recommend and things like that. And yeah, I mean, I have witnessed fathers like that, you know, who are in some way uninvolved with their children and raising their kids, but still have a large say in the home about what is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very important for me.
I guess you kind of built Farouk in a way that sometimes I would get a little bit annoyed by his just his the way of handling Fatima as well and their relationship. Because as a black woman in South Africa, I can relate to that father figure who kind of just distances himself from certain discussions, but also chips in when it suits him, right? So I think it's very like apt to read about that in that context as well. So you did that very well, and I enjoyed it. As a reader, I really enjoyed looking at that character with such interest. Andrew, you have a text that you can read for us from your title, The Fourth Boy. And I think that ties into what we just discussed with Nadia about the relationships between children and their parents.
Sorry.
No problem.
Let's just see. You marked it here.
Yes.
Okay, the little bit I'm going to read is right at the front of the books. It's not really too much of a spoiler, I hope.
Yes.
Thanks, Pelesa.
No, I do not want to spoil it for everyone.
I'm joking. Okay. He is with his mom in the hospital. She's kind of on her deathbed, and she's just a mishmash of tubes and beeping machines and everything. And she insists on giving him a letter. He's just going to nip down to get a cheese roll at the canteen of Grote Skuur. And she give me a letter, I'll come and hear it from him. He says, no, it's here. So he goes down to the canteen, opens the letter, and he reads this. June 1985, this was some months before this date. My boy, if you're reading this, chances are I'm gone. Sorry for getting cancer. Sorry for things I could have done better. I think we had an okay time, though. Shot on getting through the army and getting your journalism degree. Don't waste it and don't do any more army camps. You've done 2 years already. Don't give them more. If you ever later want to find your father, the last I heard, he lived in Oudtshoorn. The dad had left before he turned one. I never told you his surname. It is Mazra. He had to do what he did. We can't blame him. I'm so glad I had you. You have been everything, and no, you did not stop me being or doing what I wanted. What I did, I wanted to do. Chin up, my boy. Grant, I like writing that name. Love, Mom. So that was the letter that he got and read as he was trying to eat his cheese roll, which he doesn't then in the end. Do you want me to just a little bit more?
Yes, okay. A little bit more, just to get to the part where he obviously learns of her passing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I looked at my uneaten cheese and tomato roll, turned it over, rolled it to one side, then the other. I unwrapped it, took a large bite, and breathed through my nose in short gasps. And I felt tears on my face. I carried on reading, staring at nothing. I thought of the day I'd left for the army. How brave she'd been. Who knew if you'd see your son alive again? As I'd finished packing my last tog bag in my bedroom, I passed the bathroom to see her crying at the mirror. But on the Cape Town station platform, young conscripts packed in and oozing out of train windows with all those friends and families bidding a farewell, she'd been all smiles, all encouragement, all positive about the future I was about to face. That took some doing. Mazra, what kind of name is that? Slovak? Romanian? I had not had any thought about finding out who my father was, since in essence he didn't exist. I wasn't sure what to read into my mother's notion. Some kind of suggested find-yourself odyssey? Deathbed requests are really demands. I wasn't sure what to read into my mother's notion. Deathbed requests are really demands. They can place a lifetime of burden on the receiver. I didn't feel I could have that. My cousins had traveled the world with their father's ashes. They traveled from Africa to Canada to Australia and back, since no one could agree on the most appropriate venue for the scattering. In the end, it was Table Mountain where they'd started. My uncle would have hated becoming hand luggage on so many flights. I decided to have nothing to do with odysseys and self-discovery. My second gap year in a row had delivered some freelance journalism work, so I would be too busy, surely. I took the stairs back to the second floor. The gigantic hospital lifts gave me a heightened sense of mortality. The doors opened on both sides and delivered you left or right.
One door for heaven, one for hell, I imagined. You could be wheeled in flat or on a chair, or you could die in ample space. It offered too many dark possibilities in a place already humming with broken people. It made me feel like cargo. I folded the letter from my mother in half as I climbed the stairs and buried it in my pocket. As I entered my mother's ward, I automatically looked to my right to see to where the duty nurse sat behind a thick glass panel. I nodded to her, then, in the reflection, noticed my mother's bed surrounded by two doctors and a number of orderlies working fast, whispering urgent things to each other. I felt something hit me in the pit of my stomach. I didn't turn around but watched the reflection. It was a step removed. The duty nurse asked if I was all right. I nodded and sat down, now seeing the reflection in the metal panels that lined the lower wall. Strangely shaped doctors with elongated heads and fat, crushed torsos working alongside nurses whose body shapes twisted and changed as they move. A doctor turned, moved towards me, becoming blurred and large in the uneven metal, even splitting into three parts as he neared the chair I was sitting on.
I loved that part a lot. A lot, because as a person who loves to also reveal secrets, I could relate to how Grant reveals his sexual orientation in that moment as a conversation that he has internally with himself as he reads his mother's last words. Mm-hmm. As a gay man, and I did ask Andrew, if I'm allowed to say that, as a gay man, as a gay man, how important was it that you wrote this book from knowing who you are and now having to kind of deep dive into this archive of knowledge and cultural? I mean, I don't want to talk about the book entirely, but just some of the cultural elements that you've kind of embedded in the text. Mm-hmm. How important is that for you?
Well, I think
just briefly, because we also
I'll be very brief because I've taken a chunk now. it was the character is gay. It was easier for me to write that, although it could easily be transposed into a straight person. The love story in the book, which, by the way, is not his love story, it's another character, could easily have been a straight thing as well. It could very easily have been. But I wrote it from that perspective because it was something I knew, something I grew up with. I have an attitude myself, as thousands and millions of gay people do. And my attitude really was, I kind of grew up with it, yes, being an issue in the back of the head kind of thing, maybe at school more than anywhere else, but it never was something that, you know, bothered me. It never made me feel I need to be an activist. It never made me, never drove me the way it does many other people.
Yeah.
And it was something I could brush aside and, hey, if you want to talk about it, do and ask me, but I'm not going to go and stand on top of a parapet with a flag.
Yes.
Which probably makes me a bad person, or a weak person. I don't know.
I mean, as somebody that can interject there, is that what's interesting is that when I read your book, I could transpose it to my own father's life experience, who was a gay man who didn't really flag his orientation around, but ended up marrying a straight woman and had me, right? So that's a secret that you can use as you wish. but it's very important that I read it from that perspective because I kind of feel like you wrote a story that was very important because sometimes you don't need to speak about your orientation and flag it around. Sometimes you just want to be, right?
Yeah,
and I think you wrote that very well. Bonnie, we did discuss the piece that I'd like you to read as well, just to kind of contextualize where we are. Bonnie's going to read a piece from her book, Making a Killing, at the very beginning of the start of how Sylvie and Winifred meet.
Yeah. So Winifred has just left Johannesburg and arrived in a small village. And she's walking up a pathway. So I start reading now. Rain runs off the plastic mac and rivulates. The gloss of the fabric and the shape of her have me thinking of a wet seal. Red socks poke out of the top of those god-awful ankle gumboots everybody here seems to wear. A hood shrouds her head. I can see her hands cup her eyes as she peers into the shop's shadowed recesses. It's her idle curiosity, I hope. After all, no one's been interested in these premises for a while. The advert, secured by a rusty drawing pin to the general dealer's notice board, was curling and crisp with age. I make my way along the pathway and take the snaking route up to the gentle slope to the vacant shop on Reaper's Lane, then almost skid on a mossy paver. I give a startled yelp. "Oh, Yana, where have you come up from?" Her voice is deep, with a Louis Armstrong raspiness. I give the requisition smile. I can't think of the word. Then fish the key that I collected earlier out of my pocket. "Ah, you're opening. Lekker, lekker. I fancy a squiz inside. Any idea of the rental?" I knew it. She's another one of those chatty types. The village overflows with them. I hesitate, mask my wariness, and then say, "Probably best to speak to the agent." "Ja, was my kop vandag? I should have asked Daphne when I saw her earlier." "I am going to sign a lease on it." It comes out harsher than I intended, a sort of snobby and possessive. But at least she now knows that I'm not one of those gossipy types. I know the monthly rental, but I'm not planning on vying with anyone for occupancy. The key slides in, but needs a jiggle to make it unlock. I push the door. It doesn't budge. The wet wood has swollen and wedged tight. I scoop slimy vegetation away with the sole of my shoe and shove again. "Ach, let me." She nudges me to the side, clutches the handle, and leans her shoulder against the door. Then with a grunt and a heave, it swings open, taking her with it. She stands aside, legs akimbo, blocking my access. "Shoo, there's plenty of space. I fancy the raw brick wall. Gives character. I can work with that." I should barge past her, but she's dripping water. She's larger up close than I thought. I clear my throat. "Ach, jammer." She steps aside and makes her way to the right, where the wooden counter and pewter-colored cupboards contrast with the brick wall. A pungy mustiness tickles my nose. I hear her opening and banging doors. I'm drawn to the window at the rear. They're splattered with raindrops and splodges of deadless countless midges. But cleaned, they'll give a splendid view of the village green and the imposing church spire and the clock that runs 5 minutes late. I can picture the bibliophiles curled up in chunky armchairs, soaking up the view and the late afternoon sun. She's hollering at me. "Any idea of the wiring? Who is this woman?"
So I think one of the things that I enjoyed about Bonnie's book is that there's a little bit of everything, and I was mentioning to her that there's a bit of spiciness to it. And Winifred brings it, and whereas Sylvie's always this very white Afrikaans woman who's just flamboyant and tells it like it is. This kind of dichotomy that you've kind of put together between these two characters, where does that come from and what inspired that? You did mention earlier on these small towns are a little bit spicy and have many stories, but I want you to really talk about the character, the two characters themselves. I don't want you to go into the mystery part of it. And, yes.
So Winifred, I think, is a bit of me. She's left Johannesburg and she's moved to a small village. Mm-hmm. The first character was a woman called Maud, who was Maud as in here, but then a reader gave me feedback and said this novel needs to be set in England. Mm. You know, roses and, you know, teas and whatnot. And I thought, no, it's South African. Mm. So I then changed Maud to Sylvie.
Yeah.
And in fact, Sylvie comes from the Ornedorp, and she's Afrikaans.
Very much.
And when I changed Maud to Sylvie, there was just a magic because I was able to change a bit of the language and bring in a bit of Afrikaans. And we all know the Afrikaans language is just so colourful. Got some lovely sayings to it. So I just found at that stage the two characters, Sylvie brought a much livelier, more fun part
very
to the
much,
book.
Very
so,
much.
So, you know, Winifred's uptight,
definitely
buttoned up and morally correct, straight and narrow. Yes. And Sylvie, she more, you know, life just
gets
she
by.
Goes with the flow. And yeah,
definitely.
So,
I loved, and I always say this, Afrikaans is such a colourful language. Mm. And growing up in Bloemfontein, I almost can relate to the kind of words that Sylvie used a lot, you know. Oh, jammer, you know, and just this very much Afrikaans upbringing that you can kind of relate to as a character. And I quite enjoyed that. And I think people will also enjoy that a lot because the South African story is very much tied to this language of Afrikaans and just builds into different communities as well. So I think it's great that you kind of put this character together in this way.
Thank you.
I appreciated reading Afrikaans with English in between, just tied into that. Nadia, and I'm going to poke at you to also read a little bit of a passage from the beginning of the story.
Yeah, so the passage that I'm going to read is after Tasneem and her mom leave the butchery. Fatima pulled out her bank card and tapped it on the speed point while Tasneem carried the bags out of the butchery to the car. It was only when she had strapped herself into the back seat that she was able to calm down and collect her thoughts. Her father turned around in the driver's seat and opened his hand as if he were ready to collect something. "Where's the masala boor?" I asked for. She opened one of the packets and reached for a small Ziploc bag at the bottom, her fingers brushing against the cold food as she did so. She handed her father the pickled fruit and watched as he dug two fingers into the sticky substance. He sucked on the preserved jub-jub and spat the pit into his handkerchief before licking his fingers. Tasneem turned away and looked outside the window. Her mother had stopped to chat with a woman wearing a black cloak that danced around her ankles in the wind. "Can we stop by the old age home? There's something I'd like to drop off for Auntie Miriam," she asked her father. Farouk grumbled. "How long do we have to keep doing this?" "For the remainder of my studies. You know this, Daddy. The bursary comes with terms and conditions. I have to do community service in return for the funding." He muttered something under his breath and said no more. When she had got divorced, her parents had categorically refused to fund her studies, claiming that university was the reason why she was back at home in the first place. University was where she had met Shaquille and the reason why she had fallen in love and got married the non-traditional way. And now look how that had turned out. The passenger door opened and Fatima climbed in, aflutter with the latest gossip she'd heard. Farouk pretended to listen to his wife, offering a strategic, "or you must be joking," whenever he felt she'd pause to see if he was really paying any attention, while Tasneem plugged in her AirPods and drowned out her mother's buzzing with the music by her favorite band, Monarch. Rani's old age home was a double-story building that had been subdivided into four simply decorated rooms, a corner kitchenette, a sitting room, a single bedroom, and a box-shaped bathroom no wider than 2 meters in either direction. A beige curtain served as a door that led from the bedroom to a poor excuse for a sitting room. Only one armchair could fit comfortably in the space, facing a bulky television screen that dated back to 1996. Anjula, the woman who had set up this facility, had inherited the home from her deceased husband's estate. She hailed from a long line of cunning businessmen and women in India, and like her forebears, tried to make a small fortune off the most vulnerable in society, in this case, old ladies with no one to take care of them, who lived off a state pension and handouts from the local community.
Wow. I really loved that. And I'll tell you a secret as well, because now I'm just revealing a lot of secrets about me. but I think, so for me, I told Bonnie that I'm almost 40, and she complimented me and said I look younger than 40. I'm probably 27. I look 27, but in retrospect, I went back to studying a few years ago, 2 years ago actually, and in your book, Tasneem goes back to university to study. And I'm wondering, the idea of sort of seniority, so to speak, in varsity spaces, right? You're almost divorced, or you're about to get divorced in Tasneem's case, and you stay with your parents, and you are now surrounded by this big task of studying in a university full of youngsters. That mindset you obviously can relate to as well. Is there anybody from kind of your community that has kind of gone through what Tasneem has gone through that you've experienced? Because obviously you talked about the helper and also that experience as well.
Definitely. So actually a very close friend of mine, she actually got divorced. She had given up her studies to get married. She got divorced and she pursued a teaching degree, which really fascinated me, because when she got married, she was very passive, accommodating. She actually had a daughter who was born a diabetic, so she had a lot of challenges, but she overcame them, and I think she was very inspirational for me in terms of the way that she went to pursue her dreams, you know. And now, I mean, she's so happy. When you look at her now, I mean, she's got her life under control. She's reclaimed her identity, her power. So I think it's about showing that it's never too late in life, you know, to find yourself and to choose yourself and to pursue your dreams, you know. And I think there's a part later on where Tasneem speaks to her love interest and he says, at the Samosa Run, and he says, she says, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that I'm old and I'm in the setting. Yeah. And he says, I actually think that your age allows you to look at things in a very different light.
Absolutely.
And your life experience, you know, gives you a one-up. On all the other students
on all
that
the
are
others.
There.
Yeah, definitely. I don't want to cut you short. I'm mindful of the time. We have about 3 minutes, but I just wanted to delve into one more thing that I also think is very important, and those are your book covers. Can we deep dive into that a little bit, 1 minute each, about what kind of book covers you have and what inspired those book covers? I absolutely love each and every one of them. And I'll start with Andrew, because obviously as somebody that's also in the arts, I could recognize that is a very important image on your cover.
Yeah, the kickoff was that once the editing process had taken place and everything, and the cover was part of the debate and what's going to happen, it actually happened quite fast. I mean, maybe it's because I came from the world of TV and production and all that, because the feedback was immediate. So Karina of Caravan Press.
Yes. Can you put it up for us?
Oh, sorry, yes. Yeah. She she has a lovely woman called Monique, who is her graphic, I don't even know what they call them, graphic designers or designers. She tossed out a few options after reading the book, which very much captured the feel of the book. Mm. Then I threw a few comments back, and then they picked another picture, because you can't see it from here, but it's sort of two pictures.
Yes.
And the one is from the past and faded, quite obviously from the past, and has a kind of a haunting feel about it. And then it's this road that is going somewhere, you know, and that's a classic Karoo road.
Definitely.
And it did not take long to settle on it between Karina, myself, and her, which probably made it a brilliant thing.
Definitely.
I mean, I loved the cover and the font that she used on this. I had no idea. It was just
astounding. It looks like something's been chewing at it.
Exactly.
And and I love that. I thought, wow, I love that font. It's very odd.
It's very odd. Yeah. Very odd. And I like the fact that you chose photographs. Mm-hmm. It's a very good choice. It attracts the kind of reader that is very much aware of the Karoo as well, mm-hmm. and the landscape. And we talked a little bit about that earlier. I've been to the Karoo, by the way. So it's a wonderful place to be. And one day I would love to visit again. So probably visit you, Andrew.
Yes, I will.
So coming to Bonnie, your cover, I'll hold it up for you.
I've got to be careful what I say because my publisher's in the audience.
Yes.
She's probably listened to Andrew here and like, it was a quick decision. Mine was not. It was a to and fro. And all I can tell you is in the beginning I did not love this cover.
Okay.
But what I do know is that when they put it out on a catalogue to all the bookstores, and all the bookstores got is the blurb at the back.
Exactly.
And the cover, it was taken up. I mean, they haven't read the book, so they don't know if it's any good, if they're writing. And it was picked up by many of the bookstores. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, they were right, and I was wrong. So I now love my cover.
I love it too, actually. It takes a while to warm up to. And you're right.
It did for me. You should work with Andrew next time.
Exactly.
Because he was quick.
Exactly. But I think, the title Making a Killing in yellow and this very cool text makes it a little bit...
So the little skulls was my addition.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I like that. I think they did a really pretty good job. Yeah. I think they did.
They did a fabulous job.
Really pleased with it. Yeah, very much.
It and gives, I think, and I hope... the sort of cozy crime feel, but careful, there might be a little few things.
Exactly. And my mom always says, be careful, like you're saying, you know, sometimes what glitters is not always gold. Yeah. So that really does keep to the theme. But thank you so much. Nadia?
Yeah, so when I first spoke to my publisher, the first thing I said is, hey, it's not another samosa run. I don't want people to think these are samosas crossing a finish line.
Yes.
So, you know, because that's like the first image that goes to your head, you know? Yes. These samosas with these stick legs and,
Yes.
Very comedic. And I said, so I was... I had the idea, my mood board was very blue. The publisher wanted red, which actually worked out better. What came on the page from my idea was the silhouette. Because I was like, that needs to at least convey that this is about a relationship. And I'm a big, I'm big on trusting the process and believing that everything happens for me.
Yes.
So I was like, just go with it. Even the reds we disagreed on, you know, but I was like, what it ended up being was perfect.
Yeah.
The shiny cover was perfect.
Yeah.
So I was like, go with the flow, trust the universe, then it just works out.
It did, absolutely. And I think all three books are a testament of the power of collaboration and working with different people. Mm. I mean, you talk about your publisher, Andrew, and also your experience with working with Quella, is that you kind of built the narrative together. Well done on your first debut novels and for just keeping it real, really. It's been wonderful reading the books. And I will try and open up to the floor now because we have about 12 minutes. Are there any questions? Yes, ma'am. They're coming with the microphone.
That's a question for Andrew. You've with your background in theatre and television and so forth, did that influence, that type of storytelling influence writing? And if so, how did it influence your writing?
Yeah, look, that history of even at school and growing up with comedy and plays and doing one-act plays at school, all that kind of thing, and being an avid reader translates then into your university and the theatre world in my journalism degree in speech and drama was like the major.
and then working in television, first as an actor, and then after 10 years I gave that up and moved into writing and directing for decades, and then I retired from that. But all that, you can't pinpoint anything. It all comes together, and when I write, I have to be able to watch it on a screen when I'm writing, and when I read it back to myself, I have to be able to see it. Yeah. And I need to know this cliffhanger is fake and that one is good. Mm. And I'm going to throw that one out. And, you know, it's that kind of a feel that you plod your way through the book like that.
Yeah.
And it's all in one's head.
Exactly.
It's not something you can just pinpoint and say. And so the style of writing, the style of telling the story, what to hold back and when to reveal is all just part of... And so organic that you can't separate, you can't give an exploded version of it, because it all comes together.
Definitely.
You know, in the process, yeah.
It does, it does. And I love the question you asked, is that it ties in so much to the kind of direction that authors are going into, is that this mixture of life experience and fiction and facts, right? And we talked about that earlier on, about this mission of fact-finding and how you came about writing your book. Are there any questions?
Yes. Firstly, I wanted to say, when everyone was reading, I could just picture like things happening, unfolding like a TV scene. Yes. And then I wanted to ask, do you ever feel sort of shy when you're writing, like pulling from people you know in real life, that they'll read the book and be like, wait a minute, that's me, you know?
Yeah. I think also, can I ask that the authors answer, Nadia as well as Bonnie, for the rest of the time? Because I think that's a very important question around extracting and just mining other people's lives and writing it as well. I don't know if I put it exactly the way you've just put it, but yeah, I think it's important to answer. Nadia?
Yeah, so as I said, I'm not a secret keeper.
Yes.
So I have to be comfortable with people identifying themselves in my writing. So no, I don't feel afraid, you know, because I try and be fair to all my characters in any case. And I mean, I am a character myself, so I'm an open book as well, so I, that's kind of not meant for open book festival, but yeah.
Yes, I understand.
So, so people can easily see into my life, they can draw conclusions.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Definitely. I think you're right. I think you're definitely right. Because as writers, we also try to reflect certain issues that we find very important. Bonnie, what's been your experience in terms of what the lady just asked?
So I was a bit concerned about this book in the sense that, well, I wasn't when it was finally published because I disguised everybody. You live in a small village. You've got to be careful of who you might have picked some traits about. And then the other part about the book is the twist in the book. How will it be perceived by other people?
Exactly.
Please just say most people do see the humour in it. So for me, it hasn't been too scary to...
It's funny you say that. It's quite brave that you can stand on that ground and say it's not scary, because I feel it's very scary for me, because I'm just like terrified of, you know, revealing certain things that I kind of write about. But and I'm yet to write my debut novel, and I wish you all of the best with yours.
We're waiting to see you in here next year. Yeah.
One day, it's going to happen. But just to wrap up, I think we've just got 5 minutes, and I don't know if the audience has more questions. Are there any more questions? No, there aren't any questions. So I'm going to ask one more question to wrap up our discussion, and that's one of the questions I asked earlier on in our conversations over email, is that to share a safe, very safe secret about either your writing process, your own personal life, the book, a very safe secret about the book, or anything that you want to share with the audience that either has to do with your life, other people's lives. You don't have to name names.
Okay, I'll start, and just to say my secret is that I can't spell.
Okay.
You can't spell.
Words I just can't spell.
Okay.
The word awkward.
Yes.
The word tongue.
Yes.
I have a character called Myrtle. Do you know I spell it wrong every time? It's like, is it M-E-R, M-Y-R, you know? So why did I choose Myrtle as a character's name and know that I don't spell it well?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my very safe secret to share with all of you. My spelling's horrendous. Thank goodness for spell check.
Okay, yes, it is. It is. Andrew?
You're looking at me. Okay, no, safe secret. I wake up at 4 every morning, not to write, because I'm the most undisciplined writer you can imagine. I'm a kind of writer that sits and thinks about something for 3 weeks and then moves in and does it.
Mm.
And then suddenly finds 20 chores to do to get me away from the computer.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of dishwashing and stuff like that. And gardening. So that's my safe secret.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nadia?
My safe secret around my writing process is I don't read while I'm writing. I find it very difficult to read other people's novels simply because I try to keep the energy of my book clean.
Mm.
And my consciousness clean, and I don't want to absorb other people's ideas or steal the ideas or find it in my book at some point in time. So, they always say writers should read, but I sometimes go without reading for 6 months if I'm writing. And my TBR pile is like really building up then.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed this conversation.
Thank
you. It wasn't half as bad as I thought. But
thank you.
The books are available and the authors are available for a book signing. If you have a copy, please hound them downstairs. We have the next talk with Bonnie in the next 30 minutes as well included in that conversation. So please join that. It should be interesting. It's about finding friendships.
Yeah.
Yes. And yes, exactly. So please join that conversation. I think it's going to be interesting. You'll find me there as well. Thank you so much for coming and joining us in conversation with these wonderful authors. Not Another Samosa Run, Making a Killing, and The Fourth Boy. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Felicia.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. This event was made possible by the support of the City of Cape Town, the Heinrich Bull Foundation, and the Wheatfield Estate Foundation Trust.